Blog Talk Radio.
Hello to everybody out there listening to America's Great Loop Cruisers Association weekly blog radio show. As usual, Steve Cromer is with us today, and I'm Janice Cromer, the association's director. Before we get started on our show, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our Admiral sponsors. They're very much appreciated. Curtis Stokes and Associates, Dog River Marina, Dozier's Regatta Point Yachting Center, Dozier's Waterway Guide and Magazine, and Skipper Bob Publications. For those non-members out there listening to this show, the Great Loop is the continuous waterway that includes the eastern portion of North America, which of course encompasses the Atlantic and Gulf intracoastal waterways, the Great Lakes, the Canadian Heritage Canals, and the inland rivers of America's heartland. AGLCA, as we call ourselves, is an organization of people who share the sense of adventure and a curiosity about America's Great Loop. Our association's primary purpose is to disseminate information and enhance the overall experience of those learning about, dreaming of, as well as exploring and safely cruising America's Great Loop. Our website is www.greatloop.org, and we'd love for you to visit and become a member if you're not already a member. Our guest hosts this week are Gold Loopers Joe Pica and Captain Gene Schnagel. On February 5th, legislation was introduced to Congress that it would authorize the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to permanently close the waterway between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River, and that's basically to prevent Asian carp and other destructive species from reaching Lake Michigan. The act would effectively close America's Great Loop route if no other alternative was implemented. Joe and Gene each have their opinions on this critical issue, and they'll be discussing them today. If anyone has any questions or comments during our show, you can call into our toll-free number, 877-497-1815. Joe and Gene, thank you so much for being on our show today. We appreciate the time you're taking out of your schedules to help us. Joe, I know you've done an investigation on the subject. Why don't you give us your initial feelings about the controversy?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about it just being about carp, but it's actually about all a variety of aquatic-borne nuisance invasive species, if you want to call it. They call them nuisance species, and all of this is subject to some scientific data, some that's not, and most of it's contained at best in a large voluminous study called the GLIMRIS, which is the Great Lakes Mississippi River Intertidal Basin, and it's all predicated on the fact that there will be, if these species gain a foothold, become widespread and thrive, that there will be a very large negative impact, and that's subject to conjecture in some place and definitions on those biospheres and those areas of the Great Lakes. So this is covering a lot of things. It's basically many different. They consolidated it down from 235 that they knew of down to the primary few that they really concerned about, they think, represent the greatest risk. And, of course, the carp are one of those, but not the only one. The study and the whole blocking of the waterways is really targeting the Chicago area waterway system. And there's basically five primary routes to go directly from the Illinois River into the Great Lakes. However, those are not the only ways for these invasive species, some of them, to gain entry into the Great Lakes. There are many other methods, and some of them are flood-related, where certain areas of lowlands, that there's very limited blockades, and during floods they can gain entrance one way or the other. There's also the St. Lawrence Waterway, the ships and ballast, and all of those waterways are interconnected. So The fact remains, they found DNA in the lakes, but that doesn't necessarily mean the fish are there. DNA could just be flushed or carried by their vessels and not actually represent a slime off of a fish. They did find a couple of big-headed carp in Erie several years ago, but they haven't seen any since. So I guess that's it. And they rushed this glimmerous report out that formed the foundation for the legislation that was proposed. They actually put it on fast track beyond what the Corps had anticipated, taking time to really do the complete study. So this is kind of a rushed product and does not include a NEPA, which is a pretty prodigious, that's a National Environmental Impact Study, that covers a huge spectrum of what's going to go on, and that has to be done prior to any kind of a construction or government-funded project of this type. You're talking about just to do the targeted Chicago area, the complete structural blockade is targeted at today's dollars without maintenance costs of $18 billion and almost 50-year build-out. That's a long time. That's a lot of money. Of course, those monies are best estimate at this day. In 50 years, there's some conjecture that in the build-out time with some of these proposals that the species could gain entry into the lakes already and be a moot point for that particular one. But they're looking for some way.
Years is a tremendously long time.
Yeah. Well, there's get back to the point that they're looking at mitigating, and the report actually says there's no guarantees. None of these proposals are 100% guarantee the species will not be introduced to make it. At the same time, they're also hedging their bet on the evaluation of the impacts, also the valuations of the risk assessment that the species will actually get into the lake and thrive. Some of these species may not thrive in the lake. They may not have the biology that the lakes support. And in some cases, particularly with the carp, there's one particular study that said, no, the lakes do not support this kind of the carp's lifestyle, and they can't thrive in that environment. And that's why they haven't really rushed several of these waterways in the Chicago Canal System to gain entry into the lake. That's why their progress has been relatively slow, because they've found a niche in the Illinois River with its rich, incredibly rich nutrient runoffs and also associated strains that provide very good reproductive mechanisms for them. Everything needs a certain kind of a combination of things to thrive and overpower its environment. So, and I'm not going to stop here and let Jean go after it. Go ahead, Jean.
Why don't you tell us your alternative plan, Jean? It's interesting. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, I don't know if it's an alternative plan. Keep in mind that I'm not, like Joe mentioned offline, the two of us were talking. Neither one of us are scientists. That's not our purpose in this. We're both boaters. And from my perspective as a boater, I'm naturally concerned because I live on Lake Michigan. It's my home port. But everything that Joe has said so far, everything, I agree with 100%. I have the glimmerous report right in front of me right now. I've gone over it 100 times, and Joe's probably gone over it 10,000 times. But based on that report, there is no sure way to solve this problem. It's not going to happen. These species always get in. It's always happened historically. Years ago, we went through the sea lamprey issues in Lake Michigan, which almost killed off the sport fishing. We got that resolved, and as some of the other Lake Michigan AGLC boaters mentioned through their chat line, that we have zebra mussels by the billions right now, which is another problem. So it's going to be ongoing. In looking at glimmerous, what I'm seeing is, from a governmental perspective, they're really just saying, with all they submitted 8 plans from the Corps of Engineers. Out of one of those 8 plans was just leave it alone and do what we've been doing, which obviously doesn't seem to be working. The one they seem to be focusing on is plan number 6, which is the mid-system hydrologic separation, which means close off Chicago. But I'll go back to Joe again. As Joe stated, that's not the only five places that all this these problems come into the lake. I live in Milwaukee. We have the Milwaukee River. I don't want to tell you what goes into the lake from the Milwaukee River. So these things go on all the time. What Plan 6 is looking at is not actually closing off the five ports that they talk about, Wilmette, Chicago River, Calumet, Indiana Harbor, and Burns Harbor. What they're looking at is putting in permanent obstruction at Wilmette Harbor, Chicago River, Calumet City, and Hammond, Indiana. If you look, if you want to take and go online sometime and look at Global Earth, you can see that most of these shipments coming in through the Great Lakes into that area are probably rock salt and coal for the power plants and so forth. That is all east of Calumet City and Hammond. So those shipments could still come in the way they've designed it. The other barge systems coming up, those all come up to the railroad track areas and seem to be to the west of those cutoffs. Now, having said that, let's assume that the government's going to go ahead and do this. They're going to close it, and we're out of the picture, the pleasure boaters. What I'm looking at is something that I've heard put down a little bit, and that is the good old Big Chute Marine Railway. Now, to go back over Big Chute a little bit, I don't know if you're all aware of the history of it. I imagine you probably are, but just to cover a little bit, Big Chute was first put in 1914 in Canada. And the reason it was put in is that they were going to put in three locks. And at the time, because of World War I, they couldn't afford three locks. So they put in this temporary, less expensive stopgap, which was a marine railroad. The problem is it only handled small craft. Well, then in 1921, they came along where they were going to redo it again, except they also found out they had a thing called the Depression going on. So they couldn't afford to put the lock in again. And so what they did is they enlarged the railroad car to take bigger boats, but it still did the job. Then in the 1960s, they said, okay, we're going to take and we're going to put in the lock finally. Except there was a marine biologist in Canada happened to be at the lower pool below Big Chute and noticed that they had sea lampreys. They'd gotten in. And they didn't know how they got there, but he sat down and he started just watching all the boats going over Big Chute, and he observed that there were every so often you'd see a sea lamprey attached to a hull as they went over the top of Big Chute. But after they'd gone no more than 3 to 6 meters, they'd fall off, and they couldn't survive being out of the water like that. So his suggestion was, based on his research, that we're going to leave Big Chute and we're going to enlarge it to the point where it is today, where we have a railroad car that can handle up to a 100-foot boat. And it was less expensive. And it turned into a tourist attraction. And all of us who've been there, we know how people camp there. They have the marina. It built up around it. So having said all that in the history, I went and I wanted to know how much does that cost, because I'd seen a comment online where someone said the cost is very prohibitive to put in something like a Big Chute railroad, marine railroad in like Chicago. So I took a look and I contacted the Canadian authorities this week. I've been talking to a young lady who is head of the Chamber of Commerce in Fort Severn, Ontario, and they handle the Big Chute lock and all that. She was surprised when I called because she had no idea what I was talking about. They hadn't been informed that there was any incidents going on involving shutting down the Great Lakes access through Chicago, and that it would involve boaters of America's Great Loop coming through, which they rely on for business up there for the marinas and, you know, so forth, stores, whatever. So she's been assisting me. I've been trying with the Canadian authorities to, I wanted to find out what is the average operational cost for Big Chute. Just give me a rough estimate. It's kind of like the U.S. government. You jump from one agency to another, and they refer you back to the other one, and that one refer you to get back to the first one. It was like being home. And so I'm relying on her right now, and she is doing her best to slide around that by going through the Provincial Mayors Association up in Canada. And she also advised me that the mayors are part of the group that are looking at all this through our government. And so we've got some contact with them now and be working with them. All right.
And if I can interrupt just for a moment, Gene.
Please, go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, a NEPA report would even incorporate, because this specifically, the Glimmers and also the St. Lawrence, that side of the waterways, from any kind of impact, but a NEPA report would cover that as well. Go ahead, Gene.
Go ahead. And you're right on track again, Joe, as usual. So what I did is I'm proposing that if the government, I want to see them all kept open. I don't know if just shutting things down is it's like a knee-jerk reaction to something. Maybe this needs a lot more thought, and I'm not the person to do the thinking because I'm not qualified for that.
No
but
comment.
What I am looking at is if we took, if you had to shut them down, if you shut down those four points, Wilmette, Chicago, Calumet, Hammond, then why not consider a marine railroad at Chicago? By keeping that is a tourist attraction. It's also, if I remember one of the comments I saw said that there's not enough traffic with the with the pleasure craft to support that. I checked with the Corps of Engineers, and their harbor infrastructure inventories for May of 2012 states that the annual usage of Lock 1 at Chicago for pleasure craft is around 40,000 boats pass through there annually. The commercial traffic doesn't go through there. That goes down to Calumet now. It's been redirected. So very few little commercial traffic goes in and out of Chicago Lock.
Just to add something to that, Gene.
Please.
Commercial traffic is also considered to be the passenger tour boats, and they actually represent a huge number. They add a lot to that.
Right. So when you consider the amount of traffic going through there, even those passenger boats, we've probably taken a sightseeing boat in Chicago. Those boats are around, I don't think many of them are over 100 foot. Some are, I'm sure, but most of them are much smaller than that. They could do this, too, if they wanted to continue out into the lake and come back. And it's an added tourist attraction for those people going on that ride. We've have done the Great Loop and have gone through Big Chute. It's incredible. When you come over the top, you go, oh, my God, this is how the heck can I be on my boat in this? But if you put that in there, what I am looking at, and I'm just an opinion, is put two locks, or put two railroad locks, to allow for the traffic, the volumes of traffic, and also if one is down for maintenance, the other one continues. Set up a fee system as far as paying for this, just like they've done on the Erie or the New York Canal system, like they've done on the Trent Severn. Go ahead and put in if you can have an annual fee where people can use it every day of the week if they're locals. For us coming through on the Great Loop and so forth, you have a one-way pass. You just like they do in Trent Severn, just scoot on through. you're going to see commercial development around there with touristy things where people, you've got Navy Pier already. So it's a good point to grab people to come and watch these big vessels go over.
Gene, I agree with all the tourist attraction. I've been, of course, over the chute as well. But I think we're getting a little bit ahead of the game here with regard to what the proposals actually involve and the negative impacts economically. And then fundamentally, the Corps doesn't own any of this. The Corps is just the operator. And the geopolitical divisions that have to be hurdles, that have to be overcome, is really monumental with regard to doing any kind of a structural containment, because when you get in here, there's some huge engineering issues involved with this, not the least of which is stormwater management and sewage management for the entire metropolitan Chicago area. So all of this adds exponential complexities in the out years to this kind of a structure. I think that the most viable solution, and they kind of suggest that because it's their baseline. The report says to do nothing isn't necessarily nothing. It's just to do what we're currently doing, but they also added the glimmerous lock as an option, which I'm sure Gene was aware of, and that is a lock that has a water treatment flushing, truly yet to be tested, that prevents any species from getting through. But backing up beyond that, there are several studies there's at least one study that shows that the lakes cannot support a thriving population of either the bighead or the silver carp, which are the two notorious ones that everybody sees jumping out of the water. It's interesting because when you look at the breeding habits and you look at the food chain and you look at where they the temperatures with which they thrive, there's a whole lot of issues here that preclude them from really getting widely dispersed within the lakes, not the least of which is competition with feeding through the zebra mussels and the other mussel or clam that's invaded the lakes. There is a lot of extrapolatory conclusions made about what the actual impact will be throughout this report. They build this on best guess probabilities if the data isn't there, and they try and weight this best guess based upon the amount of scientific data, publications that they can source. I think that reasonably the best thing to do is to absolutely continue with the electronic barrier, which has proven to be very effective.
Going to interrupt you for 1 minute. Joe and Gene, we need to just break this very interesting discussion for a quick commercial from one of our sponsors, Winter Harbor Marina. We'll just take about 30 seconds from your discussion.
Winter Harbor Marina is located on the Oneida River, 1.5 miles west of Oneida Lake in Brewerton, New York, just minutes from Syracuse International Airport. Winter Harbor offers the lowest diesel fuel and gas prices from New York City to Canada. If you find a lower posted documented price, they will match it. Their amenities include complimentary courtesy vehicle, 24-hour pay-at-the-pump fueling, dockside water and cable TV, pristine bathrooms and showers, and emergency haul-out service. For more information, call 315-676-9276 or visit www.winterharborllc.com. Winter Harbor is a proud commander sponsor of AGLCA.
Thank you. Joe, how long has the electrical barrier been in force in the river?
Oh, gee. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I don't think more than 5 years.
Okay, I'm remembering back when this first started and they actually closed the waterway to our boaters. And they had to be through.
If I may interject a moment, I know it was in during 2005 because I went through it, so I'm not sure either how much installed
it. Gina, I forget, you actually had to be towed through the barrier?
No, we did not. We were in, there was a lot of controversy and I had been talking with the head of DNR in Chicago, and somehow down there somebody made a decision, no, if you just keep your hands in your boat, you'll be okay, and they allowed us to go through.
Joe, what do you think the objection is?
And in contrast to Gene, I had to pay the backsheesh and be towed through when they finally allowed it to happen. And since they were allowing anybody through there, because it's not just the barrier. The barrier has been modified, and the amount of electricity being generated across those anodes has been increased for efficacy. And in some cases, that's a whole different topic of conversation. But the bottom line is, I think, for the most part, it's very, very effective, and they're continuing to study it. And that's where I was leading to, that we know for a certainty there is no certainty with any of these measures as a 100% preventative. And we're looking at time periods that we ourselves don't like to see with regard to impact. But impact takes place over years and years and years. And to become fully involved with a negative impact is tough to estimate what exactly is going to happen when any one of these species finally, after 25, 50, 100 years within that environment, finds its niche. Now, Mother Nature is generally not conducive to any kind of a dominance by any single species. Over time, everything kind of plays out, but not on our schedule. But going back to the barrier and really good studies need to take place, because in some cases they have taken invasive species and turned them into an economic resource. One of the things against the carp, of course, everybody knows that they have a bad image, but in Europe and in China, they're absolutely, and that's where they're exporting most of the meats now. They're netting and they're harvesting them. In some cases, there may be control of their harvest. But bottom line, commonsensically, and having reported the government in two different careers, this kind of a prodigious project is not going to take place tomorrow. I don't think anybody should sell their boat because they're worried they won't be able to do the Great Loop, because this will not come to fruition by anybody's calendar before a new three or four generations of boaters be impacted. I think something should be done. I think it makes sense to have some kind of control measure, and I think that the barrier is currently the least intrusive and the least adverse impact for the commercial folks. Now, there's 575... Let's see, the estimate on the Glimmers, correct me, Gene, if I'm wrong, but it was $571 million in commercial cargo going through these canals. That would be
that I'm not aware of, Bill.
And part of that is calculated not based on the value of the cargo, but this is the valuation of the cost of transporting by any other means than barge. We all know that barging bulk cargo is the least expensive way to move it by ton. And if they had to, and the study, it's in one of these economic impact, the appendices, that extra cost of doing it by truck or rail, not even counting the intermodal transfer, in other words, the effort it takes to pull it out of here and put it into there, take it over there and dump it, that's extra. That's the savings that would be lost by doing it. So, and that's a bare minimum, and that's an annual amount. So there's a tremendous economic impact, almost $500 million on the face of it, of putting in a barrier that requires removing on some of the different kinds of a transportation system or like cars or rails. And the first thought is, well, we can just set up an intermodal transfer site and, as opposed to where they're currently doing, move it to the other side of the barriers. And that was a thought as well. But you're, again, when you look at the reality of the geopolitical and the private-owned systems that litter through all of this, I don't know how you're going to jurisdictional boundaries so easily, and unless you have ultimate eminent domain, which has not been done in a long time on that scale. So my cutting to the chase, this isn't going to happen, in my opinion. We don't have to worry about not being able to do the loop. They're going to continue to fine-tune what we've got. They're going to continue education and research, which I absolutely support, to make a better estimate on what would be realistic, common sense, to mitigate this. And the experts that I've personally talked with that are in the process readily admit this is not a mitigation. This is a mitigation. Prevent.
I'm sorry, you guys are breaking up. Can you hear me, Steve?
Yep.
Joe
Hello?
Was having trouble with his cell phone before.
I hear you just fine, Janice.
Okay, thank you.
You know, he may be going through some of that problem now.
Okay, can you hear me okay, Janice, or just I'm blacking out?
Yes, I can hear you now, Joe.
Okay. Well, my bottom line is that we really need to study the heck out of this because this is just simply to slow the process down, not to prevent it. And the experts admit this. And they're working on all sorts of other types of controls should the event of these species gain entry into the lakes. And a good example would be how they dealt with the lampreys, with the spawning areas and the streams and stuff. So there's other mechanisms, but it's a broad range of invasive aquatic nuisance species that they're looking at right now, and they continue to arrive. But in any case, I'll let Gene finish up if he wants. But
okay, Gene, any closing remarks?
No, just one, and that is everything Joe has said so far is absolutely right on track. And when I talk about the putting in the Big Chute Marine Railroad, what that was premised on is that if they went ahead and said, from a governmental perspective, and we all know things can happen, you can keep your doctor, but if something happened and they did do this, all I'm saying is, please, gentlemen, take a moment, take a breath, and take a look at this as an alternative so we don't get an interruption of a very big market that's running through the Great Lakes. And but currently, if they can stop the invasive species in any other ways, God bless them, go for it. So what Joe's saying makes sense to me. And
well,
so we didn't have it.
Thank you very much, Joe and Gene. This has been extremely informative. I think many of you have probably seen on our webpage, we do have a petition, and we're very trying to be open-minded. The petition states, please keep the Great Loop open and separate any danger, keep our lakes and our waterways clean, but find an alternative if needed. If you believe in that statement, please sign the petition. If anybody has any questions, please use the discussion forum. And I guess that's it for this week again, Joe and Gene. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
My pleasure as well.
Thank you. Until next week, safe cruising.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, Gene. Nice talking to you.